snorkeling for snickerdoodles and snarge. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 131. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your sparkly, sparky, sparring Spartans.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Cerebral Spartans.
You can add stuff now.
And this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one beautiful website-making platform. Exciting news, Squarespace just launched Squarespace 7, which makes things even simpler and easier to make your dream website.
Do you just think of the website and it appears?
I wish.
Squarespace 9.
That's Squarespace 9.
Yeah. One day we're going to get there. And I have a quick reader email I want to read to you guys. We get fan mail a lot. And this one, I was like, oh, we got another fan mail. And I read it. I was like, oh, wait, that's not really to us. This one is from Bailey. And Bailey said, I've been listening to Good Job Brain since the beginning and I love it. I was like, oh, great. And then Bailey says, but I'm not emailing today to thank you for all the fun trivia that I enjoy so much. I'm emailing you to say thank you for introducing me to Squarespace. Long story short, my professors required me to get my essays on the web. I had to make a site. I was daunted by the task of building a site and seriously considered going the route of some of my academic colleagues by buying a pre-made site for thousands of dollars.
What? What school does she go to?
Madness.
Yeah. Can you?
How fancy of them.
Do people do that?
Yeah, you can buy a pre-made. Yeah.
For thousands of dollars?
Well, you know.
I guess we'll sure. know. And Bailey says, then it hit me. Good job, Brain said to use Squarespace. I took your advice, and in a few weeks, I was up and running. And her website is called Well Done Ladies, welldoneladies.com. And then Bailey closes out saying, thank you again for not only providing my weekly podcast entertainment, but a big fat A+ this semester.
Nice. Oh.
Well done, lady.
Yeah, well done, lady.
We'll grudgingly share some of the credit with Squarespace, yeah. I suppose.
But look, we actually helped someone.
Yeah,
that's
we were like the matchmakers. This was like the thank you letter sure. to the matchmaker.
You didn't have to spend thousands of dollars like your colleagues. Those are suckers.
Suckers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so last week, Chris, you did a quiz about state.
Official state things. Yeah.
And then this week I saw New York got an official state snack.
Oh.
Which is...
Like official?
Yeah, the governor signed it into a bill of some... or. Whatever, signed it into law.
Whatever, however it is so, that they do it.
Yes,
yeah.
The New York
blood sacrifice.
Yeah. That's right. Delicious.
The official I believe state he has to eat 100 pounds of whatever the snack is.
What is it?
To make it official.
It's yogurt.
Yogurt.
Weird.
The new state snack.
I don't think New York.
Yeah.
I think most yogurt in America is made in New York, though.
Ooh, let's look this up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that where Chobani is?
Oh, mm-hmm. You're right. New York State produced 741 million pounds of yogurt last year.
Yeah.
And the two leading brands of thick Greek-style yogurt, Chobani and Fahe, have large production plants in New York.
Well, there you go.
So there's a reason for it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. There is. Yeah. Not just because people like it. I thought it would be like pretzels or pizza.
Yeah, but there's no money in
or peanuts. there's no pretzel plants.
And they don't eat a lot of pizza in New York anyway.
And I have a addendum, Chris, also to your official state what's its quiz.
Okay, all right.
Jess wrote in. She said that one of the questions mentioned was North Carolina.
Yeah.
Official carnivorous plant.
Official carnivorous plant.
Right. Venus flytrap. Yeah. And we were like, oh, that seems so random. Uh-huh. The Venus flytrap is native only to the Carolinas.
Get out.
Yes. Because of the climate and the weather.
Sure.
Not because there's like a...
That's where they're
perfect,
from.
That perfect mix of...
yeah.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Lots of bugs.
Insects are just tasty enough.
Yeah, great barbecue. Yeah.
Well, they season in the Carolinas, they season their insects with vinegar rather than sweet barbecue sauce. Right. So the plants like it a
lot. Not a rub.
Right. Yeah. I prefer a dry rub fly myself.
Right.
Yeah.
North Carolina has been having problems with Venus flytrap poaching over the past few years, and the state recently made digging up the plant a felony.
Oh.
Because someone decided to dig up most of the park's Venus flytrap plants over a single weekend in 2013, stealing over 1,000 plants.
Wow.
That's...
a lot of plants.
That's a lot. That seems painful. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
That's either theft
or... No, they're not Audrey 2 from Horrors.
They're staging a revival.
They don't take your finger off.
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't be able to take 1,000.
Yeah, that's right.
So there you go. Well, there is an explanation.
All right, North Carolina, your export to the world.
I love it. All right. Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hot Shot. Here, I have a random Trivial Pursuit card. I'm going to make up a question for this one.
Picture. Is there a picture on it?
Yeah. Mm. All right. Blue Wedge for geography, but this is the sub in question, so it's nothing to do with geography.
Oh, okay.
All right. The name of this album featured songs such as You Give Love a Bad Name, Living on a Prayer, and Wanted Dead or Alive. Chris, or was it Colin?
We think we both have.
Okay, everybody together.
Was that Slippery When Wet?
Correct. Bon Jovi.
I can see the card. Oh. And it's got the picture is the Slippery When Wet road sign. The question was, what is this?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the answer is Slippery When Wet for both questions.
The Slippery When Wet road sign really looks like, snakes.
Yeah. Snakes may be following
snakes
your car.
Snakes may be following
just
your car.
The picture.
Snakes right. on a car.
Yeah.
Yep.
Pink Wedge for pop culture. Who, according to legend, was advised to stick to truck driving because he'd never make it as a singer?
Chris. Johnny Cash?
Incorrect. That's my first guess, too.
No, it was
Elvis
Dana.
Presley?
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dan is right. Elvis Presley. Yellow Wedge. Who was the only U.S. president never to marry?
Multiple choice. Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
James Buchanan, Thomas Jefferson, or Richard Nixon? Oh.
Oh. Oh, hey. Oh, hey. Now.
Colin.
That's Buchanan.
Yeah. Pat
the
Nixon.
Other two, yeah. And there's and Jefferson definitely got married. But you can't cheat on your wife if you don't have one in the first place.
Snip, snap.
As the old saying goes. Yeah.
Too soon.
Put him on show.
Oh, man.
All right. Purple Wedge. What 2001 book noted that McDonald's was the biggest U.S. buyer of beef, pork, and potatoes? Everybody.
Fast Food Nation.
Correct. Fast Food Nation.
It's right there in the...
It is indeed.
Right there behind us. Yeah.
It's in the Good Job Brain Library.
Yep.
Potatoes.
Yeah.
Just for hash browns?
Oh, French fries. French fries. McDonald's. Oh, McDonald's.
Hey, man.
Yeah.
I just ran a half marathon this morning.
All right.
Cut me some slack. Oh, shout out to Christine, who I met. Nike Women's Half Marathon.
Aw.
I hope you had a good race. All right. Anyways, back to the card. Let's see. Green Wedge for science. Okay. Why do male mice sing?
Why do
it's
male...
It's like a riddle.
Yeah. Why do male mice
Yeah, it does sound like a bad Laffy Taffy joke.
Well, you buzzed in, right?
Yeah.
Colin. Mating ritual? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, to attract the
it's always
female
about,
mice.
To attract, it says literally to attract female mice.
Wow.
Okay.
Huh. A little note here says male mice produce elaborate ultrasonic vocalization during courting.
Oh. Mm.
And they only sing Three Blind Mice.
Yeah.
All right. Last question, Orange Wedge. What organization was plagued by the curse of the Bambino?
Oh. that was the Boston Red Sox.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Baseball, professional baseball club. It was said in the many years until they won a World Series. Does it say on the card?
The note says the quote curse was reversed in 2004 when the team won its first World Series in 86 years.
Got it.
Yeah.
The curse alludes to the fact that they had Babe Ruth on their team, the Bambino, and traded him away to the Yankees, where he went on to have some small degree of success.
Yeah. Wasn't that movie Fever Pitch right around that year?
It was that year.
That was the year they won. They were filming
the movie Fever Pitch, and then it was getting closer and closer, seeming like they were going to win, and so they sort of held off on like finalizing the ending to the movie.
But then
they filmed the ending to the movie
live
when they actually won.
And you can still see them like jumping around on the field like in footage of that game.
Oh,
it's not like CG. It's like
really there.
Interesting.
Yeah, right? That is an interesting bit of trivia.
Yeah. All right, good job, brains. And so this week, we're going on the nerd route a little.
Okay.
Well, traditional nerds.
Yeah. Traditional nerds. Yeah,
yeah. I was like, as opposed to our
This is the OG. I think
we're always on the nerd route.
Well, yeah. Yes.
If the first 130 episodes didn't seem nerdy to you, then...
Yeah. Hold on
Get
to
ready,
you.
Guys.
Yeah. Yeah, we're about to step it up.
I mean, in, 130-some episodes, a lot of... some of our segments and past quizzes have dealt with book titles, authors, biography. Mm-hmm. Chris, you're a fan of the what line is this from? Yep. And so today we decided to dedicate a whole episode on books. The library is open.
I can be anything. Take a look. It's in a book. A reading rainbow.
A reading rainbow.
A reading rainbow.
I have assembled a grab bag.
That was
quiz.
A little JFK-ish.
I've created for you guys a grab bag trivia quiz of book facts, book notes, book references, literary fun.
Literary fun.
Yeah. Doesn't it just sound like it oozes fun?
Yeah.
Sure.
All right.
Yes. No punny
name for this one, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
All right. Yes. Yes. Like me, you guys have read many, 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 many books. And as you know, sometimes you're reading a book, there's a lot of stuff you got to get through before you get to the meat of the book, you know, like to really get underway. So.
Whoa.
Is that the technical term?
Yeah. Meat of the book. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want you guys to put these elements of a book in the proper order for me.
All right.
So you tell me, if a book had all of these, what order would you find them?
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The prologue.
Okay.
The preface.
Uh-huh.
The introduction. And the foreword.
Okay. All right.
So put them in order.
Before the book.
These are all things before you really get underway.
So it's prologue, preface,
introduction,
forward.
And there is an order?
There is a generally accepted order for these in a book. Okay. One will come before another, one will come before another. If you have them, they're not all the same thing. They're not interchangeable.
All right.
Chris.
Preface, forward, introduction, prologue.
Incorrect.
Ooh.
You got a couple in the right position.
Okay.
You got a couple in the right slots.
Yeah.
Forward. Am I wrong already?
You're correct so far.
Oh, okay.
That's what I thought.
We'll
do this. Yeah,
this
you're correct
is like
so far.
Mastermind.
There you go.
Because the foreword, importantly, is written by someone else.
Yeah. Yes. And so it's like they take the whole package and then they're like, this is a book about blah, blah, blah.
Right,
and you'll
right,
see
right.
in
okay.
the introduction,
okay.
blah. Yeah.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So nothing comes before the forward.
I think preface, intro,
yep.
prologue.
Is that it?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Forward, preface. Introduction,
prologue. So the introduction is by the author.
Let's run through them very quickly.
Sure,
yeah,
sure,
you guys are absolutely right. Yeah, the foreword, most importantly, is not written by the author of the book.
Yeah.
The foreword is generally like someone who has name recognition. Yeah, it is. It's like an endorsement or kind of
and
like
it's about the book, not really about the story.
It can be very general. Yeah. It can be very general. It's more just like, I'm this famous person you may have heard of. Mm-hmm. I recommend this. This may be a friend of mine. I liked it. I think you'll like it too. The preface is kind of how did this book come to be? What was the inspiration? You know, what was the process? You know, I first was intrigued by this. You know, stumbling through the little sort of the personal story. If you have acknowledgments, they would go in there as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sometimes they'll have acknowledgments in a separate section. This would come right after the preface if you did.
Wow.
Yes, okay. It's a very strict order here. And then the introduction, also by the author, is kind of like, here's what I'm going to be talking about. Mm-hmm. Here's maybe a few of the questions I'm going to answer. Kind of like just sort of, you know, telling you what's yeah, yeah. Setting the stage, a little teaser of what's to come.
And prologue is like the story.
Right.
Part of
That's right.
Supposed to skip it. I know people who do skip the
prologue.
Oh, really? Really?
Because sometimes it's very self-indulgent. Like, you don't learn anything.
Man,
that's
a lot of stuff before, like, the actual first page of
the story.
Well,
not every book
will have all
of those things.
That's true. And I am leaving many other potential elements out. You're like, I'm 50 pages in with these little Roman numeral pages. When is the story going to start? The Pulitzer Prize for Fiction honors excellence in fiction by American authors.
Oh.
Yes. Ideally, they say for stories that deal with the American experience, however you choose to define
that. I did not know that. I thought it was just a good piece of fiction.
The only requirement is American author. Yeah. But beyond that, you know, they sort of have their rough guidelines. So tell me, this Ernest Hemingway novel is the shortest book to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Karen.
Old Man Sea?
It is. Old Man in the Sea. Yeah. Yeah. With anywhere from 120 to 140 pages, depending on the edition. Yeah, it's a relatively slim novel. Yeah, the shortest to ever win the Pulitzer for fiction. We'll go the opposite direction here.
Yeah.
We'll go the opposite direction here. Published in multiple volumes from 1913 to 1927, this landmark work by a French author lays claim to the Guinness World Record for longest novel.
Oh, this comes up a lot.
This does come up a lot.
I
will accept one of three possible names, even.
Yeah.
Karen.
Is this Proust?
Yes.
Oh!
This is Au Recherche du Temps Perdu.
Absolutely is. Yes, yes. And thank you. Bonus points for the French there, Chris. Yeah. Absolutely, right. A la Recherche du Temps Perdu. Remembrance of Things Past, or In Search of Lost Time. Is how it's translated in English usually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, right here. I mistakenly masculinized it. Whoops, my bad.
Well, we're going to have some literary nerds listening to this show. Yeah, 7 volumes, over 3,000 pages, 1.2 million words. This is interesting. Guinness, for their record, they go by the character count. That's how they quantify this as the longest novel.
Okay.
It's with a...
So not words.
Over 9.6 million characters.
That's, I like that because that's more technical.
I kind of like it too.
Yeah. Because you can have a super long word.
Or a super short word. And right. Yeah, and they count spaces as characters as well. Like a lot of things that are in Guinness, of course, there is even a little bit of dispute about this. There is an even older French sort of multi-part novel that some people... By their count, they count it as the longest novel. Guinness doesn't. They don't go by that. I think their reasoning is that this was more like a serialized novel originally. That's what Guinness goes by. We've gotten this one in trivia several times before, so we'll see how well you guys remember this one. If you list the books of the King James version of the Bible in order, so beginning with Genesis, then Exodus, and so on, what is the first book named after a woman?
Oh.
Karen.
Ruth.
It is Ruth.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
What was the other one that we were thinking?
Esther.
Esther. Yeah. Esther comes several books later. Right. Yeah. We're like Ruth or Esther. Yeah. I think we had it down to 50-50.
We got it, though.
Are those the only two books named after women?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And if you want the order, it is, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. And then, there, of course, there's famously an album titled Joshua, Judges, Ruth.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Good way to remember it. Huh. In bookbinding.
Remember what, the Bible or the album?
You know, whichever one you happen to have handy. If you've got the Bible handy, you need to remember the album. That's the beauty of it. It goes both ways.
I know, it's
three
consecutive ones.
In bookbinding, bookmaking terminology, what is a signature? What is a signature? If you were making a... Chris.
A signature is you have the book and then you have all the little mini books inside that make up the book that are all bound together. A signature is one of those.
Absolutely right.
Yes.
Yes. It's the little mini booklet, usually sewn together.
When you crack open your hardcover book, you see like it's actually a whole bunch of little, you know,
little volumes.
Booklets.
Little mini booklets. Mm-hmm. Typically, you want to go a real deep nerd here. You want typically how many pages are in a signature?
100.
Going way back, the typical is 16 pages.
Okay.
Yeah, you can have many different numbers. All right, last one. In 2013, in San Antonio, Texas, the new Bexar County Library opened to much fanfare. What was unique about this library? Chris.
Didn't have any books.
It is the first all-digital public library.
All right.
Yes.
Is it just like... E-book. A terabyte drive?
No, I mean, you can go in and you can, like, borrow ebooks on your device, and it signs them out to you, and then, you know, you sign them back to the library, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. The Bexar County Digital Library, they're quite proud of us, known as the Bibliotech. Get it? Like T E C H.
Get out of here with your. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get out of here with your capital T in the middle of the word. Yeah, opened last year. No printed books whatsoever. And they are committed. This is their mission. They've got over 10,000 ebooks. They've got, yeah, hundreds of e-readers there, dozens of computers and laptops. Okay. If so you don't have your own digital device,
you can basically borrow device.
Yep. You can borrow a device and read it there. You can borrow it on your own personal device if you have. Yep. You can check them out for 2 weeks at a time.
You can do that with the San Francisco Library, Oakland, and Berkeley, too.
And then they just magically...
Yeah, New York Public Library, famously, is adding a lot more of those, too.
Bibliotech.
Yeah. There are other libraries that have experimented with, like, digital branches, but none of them have been able to sustain and, you know, say, because yes, we're going to stay all digital. Yeah, there was one branch of a library in Arizona that tried it, and they eventually had to start adding printed material. Just their patrons demanded it. It just was what they needed. But no, this library in Bexar County, they have a budget. They're going to add 10,000 ebooks every year and stay all digital. That's what they're committed to.
Save so much space.
Yeah.
And storage. Oh, it looks upkeep.
It looks really cool and very futuristic, of course, as you might imagine.
What? Why there? Do you know? Like, is it just a county decision?
It was. Or? It was by the county. Yeah.
How progressive.
Yep. All right. Well done.
So you guys know I'm a collector mostly of video games.
Yes.
I own a lot of books that sort of orbit around that collection and other books as well. So of course I put together a quiz for you guys about cold hard cash, the most valuable books.
Oh, cool.
In the world.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Well, let's see how you guys do. Mm-hmm. So, one of the most valuable books in the world is called the Bay Psalm Book, Book of Psalms from the Bible, right? It was originally printed in 1640. There are only 5 complete copies still in existence. One of them in 2013 sold for $14.2 million.
Wowzers.
Why is the Bay Psalm Book so valuable /
other
notorious,
than the fact that's old?
There's a reason why this particular book is in high demand.
Okay.
Karen.
Was it signed by a particular famous person?
Any copy you had of this book would be very valuable. Karen.
It's bound in human skin.
It is not bound in human skin. Glad that's where your mind immediately went.
Yeah.
No, it is not bound in human skin.
And whatever
Bay,
it is, applies to
B-A-Y, Psalm, P-S-A-L-M. The Bay Psalm book, yes, it applies to all of them. It's just... The very existence of this book, it was originally printed in the year 1640.
Okay, so something, I guess something with like, yeah, the pilgrims, maybe something around there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like maybe the first one printed in America. Or
is that your final answer?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It is, in fact, the first book ever printed in America. 1640 is apparently only 20 years after the pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock. It was fast. So yes, it is the first book ever printed in what would eventually become the United States of America. Yes, indeed. The Bay Psalm book.
That's cool.
It's bound in human skin. Another thing that has to do with America, copies of a book called The Birds of America have sold for $7 million, $8 million, and $11 million approximately. Who is its author? Dana.
Audubon.
Yeah. John James Audubon. The Audubon bird study
Baron.
Watching.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
He was Mr. Bird.
Yeah.
Bird man.
But his last name was Audubon.
Yeah.
Of the various books, editions of books that have sold for over $3 million. There are not many. There are not many books that have sold for $3 million. Of this small group, only one of these books was written in the 21st century.
Oh, wow.
What is the book?
And it's just one particular
It is one part. It is a certain copy of a certain book.
In the
21st century.
At
the time, there were only 7 copies of this book. This was the only one that was being made available. Outside of the author's small circle of friends.
Whoa. Harry Potter was a good guess. Yeah, I like that.
Like Notebook, you know. Like,
I give up.
It is Harry Potter related.
Yeah, that's what I...
It is the book Tales of Beedle the Bard, written by J.K. Rowling after the final Harry Potter book came out. She made 7 handwritten copies, and 1 was sold at auction for well over $3 million.
Handwritten?
Yeah, well, it's a short book. It's a tale, the children's tales from the Harry Potter world. And Amazon bought it for over $3 million.
Just to keep.
Yeah. Just have it.
Not to sell.
They
to have it,
it
to talk about
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, remember, nobody had read this book either, so they actually, they made a whole big deal out about, they wrote a summary, they wrote a review of the book so that people can understand what was actually in it. But then eventually it was published and, you know, more broadly disseminated. But yeah. In 1987, the Japanese bookseller, the very old established Japanese bookselling company, Maruzen, paid over $5 million, and this is in 1987, for a copy of this book, which was printed in 1455. Dana.
The Art of War?
It's not The Art of War.
1450.
Karen.
Tales of Genji?
Not Tales of Genji. Get yourselves out of Japan. Asia. 1455, they paid. And this was at that point, it was more than double the previous record for a printed book. This is 87. This is like primo time for Japan's economy. They had tons of extra cash. This book represented a major technological leap, if you
Was it Gutenberg's
Bible?
It was a Gutenberg Bible. Yes. It was Steve Gutenberg's Bible.
Right after Three Men in
Yeah. He was big. It was 87.
Police Academy.
It was one of Johann Gutenberg's original Bibles, one of the first things printed with movable type.
Wow. Cool.
In the year 2010, I wouldn't call this a book, but a 2-page written document written by a man named James Naismith sold for over $4 million. What was it? Colin.
That would have been the rules for basketball.
The rules of basketball.
Oh, of course.
The original rules of basketball. That's right. Well, you probably heard the name James Naismith
at
some point, but it's in the punch bowl, right?
It's in the punch bowl.
Finally, the most expensive work, I believe, of narrative fiction ever sold. Most expensive work of narrative fiction ever sold. So not the Bay Psalm book, which is Psalms from the Bible. Most expensive work of narrative fiction ever sold. Had a plot that revolved around a convoluted dinner bet. What is the book?
Convoluted dinner.
Dinner bet. Everybody was betting a dinner on something.
That sounds familiar.
Doesn't it?
It really does.
Doesn't it?
Dinner bet.
The dinner bet.
Agatha Christie?
It was about people telling stories, and whoever told the best story, everybody was going to buy them dinner.
Oh,
Frankenstein?
No.
Yes, right? Wasn't that? Oh, no, that was the real life circumstances.
That's right.
Oh, wait, no, that was life, not art.
This is a summation of the plot of The Canterbury Tales. As everybody was going to Canterbury, they all made a bet.
That's right.
Says whoever can tell their tale the best, everybody else will buy them dinner later.
Was the premise. I just remember a bunch of people on a journey.
Right. Now it was all a dinner bet. Sold for $7.5 million in 1998. As I said, it was the last first edition of The Canterbury Tales still remaining in private hands.
Oh, God.
Okay. Everything else at that point was in a museum.
Cool.
Pricey books.
I too have a book quiz for you guys.
Oh, we're quizzing it.
Booking it. Did you guys have the book it thing when you were in like middle school?
Maybe.
Maybe this was just East Coast, but I think some people
like Scholastic book orders?
Yeah, no, it was like book it. And it was like you had to like read as many books as you could and like they had a big chart.
We got a star. I chose really easy books.
Well,
like,
they make you game the system. That's what it is. It's like encouraging you to game the system because it's not how many pages you read, it's how many books.
I wouldn't even enjoy it. Like they kind of ruined it.
My strategy was I would find books that were like 3 or 4 volume sets or something like that, you know, because they would usually be a little bit thinner. Yeah, so
I read I would be like, remember those horror stories like Tales of Terror or whatever with a really creepy watercolor drawing?
Like, it's a book.
Yeah, I was like, it's a book.
Yep.
But did you guys have Scholastic book order?
Yes.
Like
yeah,
a catalog.
Yeah, we did.
I always get the non-books.
I really
like the
stickers.
Science kits.
I look forward to that day. Yeah. That was great.
That day is great.
So a few episodes episodes ago, I did a segment called "You Burnt Classic Literature"
on Amazon.
Yeah, so I took 1-star reviews from Amazon, and they kind of included a summary of the story. You guys had to guess what the story was, and so this is "You Burnt" part two, but with children's literature. Oh. And instead of Amazon, I found Goodreads has amazing reviews. They're just fascinating to read, like if you're bored. Look at the Goodreads reviews.
They're so really, are they, right. Yeah. Is this children reviewing the books or their parents?
Oh no, the best ones are the parents. Sometimes kids do it, but the really like sarcastic, cut to the bone,
like
come from parents who are super bored with the book, but had to keep reading it. These are classics. You guys know what these are. So let's get this started. I'll read you part of a review, a 1-star review from Goodreads, and you guys buzz in and tell me what story they're describing.
All right. And these are all negative reviews.
These are 1-star. Yeah. I did not enjoy this story so much, I'm going to write a review about it kind of reviews. All right. A disturbed young man in a devilish costume chases a dog with a sharp object, then threatens to cannibalize his mother when she objects. No, it's not an episode of True Blood. This is actually the opening scene of an inexplicably beloved children's book.
Oh. This sounds like Where the Wild Things Are.
Where the Wild Things Are. Maurice Sendak. I mean, this person hated it. It goes on and on.
That's just a sampling of their vitriol.
Not to be mean to anyone, but why does everyone like this book? Not that I don't like animals, but why does everyone love this book so much? I could write a book about a cat saving a monkey. Would you automatically buy it? My point is, what's so good about a spider saving a pig? Oh. The movie is not one bit better. In fact, it has to be one of the worst books I've ever read.
No! Oh.
Chris.
Well,
that is, of course,
Charlotte's Web.
Charlotte's Web.
But there are a lot where it's like, I don't get it. The pig was stupid. The spider was smart. It's like, yeah, that's how the story was.
Like a circle of life.
It was a generous spider. You got it. Anyway, okay. How about this one? Mice are still pests. This one in particular wants to be waited on hand and foot.
Stuart Little?
No.
If you give a mouse a cookie.
Yeah. Because it's like, if you give a mouse a cookie,
he's
like,
probably gonna want
some milk. And then
if
blah, blah, blah.
Give him milk. He's probably going to want some chocolate for the milk.
I don't know that one.
There's another one for this one. I just don't get it. It's a stupid mouse. Tell him no. He doesn't have to get everything he wants.
When's someone going to stand up to this mouse?
Right. In a word, trite. I know that sounds snobby, but come on. Anne is the epitome of a Mary Sue character. Aw, poor thing. She's too skinny, and her red hair is too unique, and she's just so quirky. Isn't she just the perfect little flawed heroine? Actually, no. She's obnoxious. Even as a child, I couldn't buy into this garbage.
Little redhead Anne of Green Gables?
Green Gables?
Yes.
Oh.
Anne of Green Gables.
I thought she was a little bit annoying, too. Yeah.
Okay. You need to be able to separate your feelings about the character from your feelings about the book.
Yeah.
It
seems classic
personal.
Mary
yeah.
Sue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa.
There's, I mean, many of these reference Mary Sue's. Mary Sue's, if you guys don't know, are in certain literature, when you think that the author is like projecting themselves into the story or they're setting up like a perfect life for this perfect character.
Right.
That you see yourself in.
It's self-insert fan fiction when they're too self-conscious to put themselves in. So they're like, instead of like, you know, Chris goes to Hogwarts and solves everybody's problems. Yeah. It's like, oh, there's a new student at Hogwarts. His name is
Christian.
Chris. And he is very popular and so handsome. Everybody loves it.
It's your own wish fulfillment. Yeah.
It's so good that he got sorted in all of the houses. But he kicked,
And then he got sued by J.K. Rowling.
Now he lives in a box. The end. That's a sad Mary Sue fanfic.
Miniature people living in a big old house and making friends with the boy who lives there sounds like a fun adventure. Sadly, this story bored me and I was skeptical about a lot of the size proportions and resources.
This is very skeptical.
Colin.
Sorry.
Oh, I thought it was the Littles, but maybe
the Borrowers.
The Borrowers.
Oh. Yes. Oh, Arrietty.
All over. Now Arrietty, the Borrower. The Borrower, the Studio Ghibli. Yeah.
I like that.
I read that book back in the day, though.
I'm skeptical
about the size.
Well, yeah, because at that size, the best way is to actually have an exoskeleton.
Right.
And not have, like, you can't just shrink a person.
Should just be an insect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. it's a surface to volume ratio.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I'm going to go write my own one-star yeah. review. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, lady, yeah. you're right.
I would like to echo the earlier reviewer's concerns.
Control
in science.
Yeah. You see how fun trolling
yeah,
can be.
True. It's a really slippery slope. You're right.
It really Oh my goodness, how incredibly lame. It seemed like each page I turned got lamer. He falls off a mountain that he drew, and since he didn't finish drawing, there's no other side of the mountain, so he's falling in thin air. So good thing for him, he still had his stupid purple crayon. Roll eyes.
That's the
Harold.
Oh, Harold. Okay,
and the crayon.
Harold and the purple crayon.
Oh, got it. I was yeah. like Matthew and the purple crayon.
Who drew?
Horton here's a purple crayon.
Who wrote that?
Crockett Johnson.
Yeah.
I would never have been able to pull that one out.
All right. One more.
Okay.
Apparently, Scholastics did not read this before they put it on their book list for young children. If they did read it and endorsed it anyway, we have a problem. The heroine here is a small child, seemingly gifted, who is verbally, mentally, and emotionally abused by her parents. She goes to a school where the headmistress openly states she hates small children and physically abuses them with impunity. What the H? That's what they wrote.
Wow.
That's what they wrote.
What the H?
Yep.
Matilda.
Matilda.
Yeah. Right, Roald Dahl.
I'll say his books are
dark.
Child abuse was a running theme in a lot of his books.
Well, yeah.
It was a running theme in a lot of people's lives.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true at that time.
Multifaceted.
I feel that way about like Lewis Carroll. Like, just a very interesting life and some questionable parts of it, but mm-hmm. he's an interesting dude. Just you're like, okay, yeah. I see why you maybe felt the need to channel this into stories.
Roald Dahl also wrote like short stories, like not for kids. Like,
oh yes,
adult. And those are what the H?
Yeah,
those are real H.
I read them when I was a kid because I was like, I love Roald Dahl, and I was like,
it's terrifying.
There's no chocolate factory in here.
That's a different kind of factory.
Also, for the record, and I just double checked this on the internet, because I just read this and I was like, oh no, I've been saying it wrong. It's actually pronounced Rule.
Ruled.
Ruled, though.
Yeah, the D is silent.
Rule.
Is he Welsh?
Rule. Yeah, he is.
He has a plaza in Cardiff.
Yeah, I've been there. I was like, oh, they were having a festival for him.
Yep.
I didn't talk to anybody. That's why I didn't know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, exactly.
It's where the Torchwood offices are.
It's hard to figure out.
That's right.
All right, let's take a quick break. A word from our sponsor.
I'm Lando Calrissian, one of the best sabacc players in the galaxy. For me, quality and price are everything, so I turn to Squarespace for all my website needs. With easy video embedding and an elegant sound player, it's easy for me to show off my little maneuver at the Battle of Tanab for anyone who wants to see it. I also like to maintain a blog for my handsome thoughts, photo galleries to showcase my personal array of blue capes, map integration to pinpoint my favorite places in Bespin. Squarespace, you too can have a website that truly belongs with us here in the clouds. I love a good deal, and I'm in good spirits to share. So get 10% off your first purchase using the code GOODJOBBRAIN.
Who's got something to plug?
I do. So the last few weeks, I've been tweeting a weird word every day. You can follow me at Words Are So Weird. October is Creepy Word Month, so all the words are creepy or spooky or about being scared or...
Give us a taste.
So one of my favorite words so far this month is cacoethes, which means the irresistible urge to do something inadvisable, like the little voice in your mind. Cacoethes. It's cacoethes. Cacoethes. It rolls off the tongue. It's so so. Along with the words, I make a little picture that goes with it.
Those are awesome. Super funny.
Very silly, kind of dry and dorky. Anyway,
and educational.
We learn and laugh and love. So that's at Words Are So Weird.
Follow it. And we're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain, and this week we're talking about books.
We are. And we're going to go bookception here. I'm going to read to you guys from a book, in a book about books. We are surrounded by the Good Job Brain Library. One of the books I pulled down off of my shelf is a book called The Book on the Bookshelf by Henry Petrosky.
So meta.
It is a very nerdy, designy, kind of broad history book. Very broadly, it's about bookshelves and the history of books and book storage. That's sort of its very high level.
There's that much to write about book storage?
Yeah. Karen, you should know you can nerd out about anything. That's true. Nerd out about anything. And, you know, the history of bookshelves, it's one of those things like where we take a lot for granted. And as I read this book, I realized how much we take for granted. Just a lot of the simple things that seem obvious to us now about how we would store and keep books were totally not always that way. So I'll show you a little anecdote here from the book that Henry Petrosky relates, because I think this story kind of touches on a few of like the major turning points in how we deal with books. Okay. So in 1444, Oxford University, may have heard of it, they appointed the Duke of Gloucester to help build their new library. All right. So, I mean, you know, even though this is 1444, they still an institution of some regard already. And in particular, the problem they were hoping to solve in their new library was overcrowding, okay? Mm-hmm. And the overcrowding was different from what you might think of when you first hear about library overcrowding. I'll read you a quote here. In particular, they were concerned, quote, "Should any student be poring over a single volume, as often happens, he keeps three or four others away on account of the books being chained so closely together."
Oh, they're chained together?
Chained. Why were they chained? Why is this a concern? So what they're talking about this problem is, in an old style library up into as late as the 1500s even, you would have a fairly small collection. Books were rare. Books were, you know, they were the dominion of universities and monasteries largely in the West, and they were valuable. And you might only have a single copy of any given book. You probably would only have a single copy of almost all of your volumes, and you wanted to literally keep someone from borrowing it and forgetting to bring it back. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, in a most extreme case, walking away with it. When he talks about overcrowding and putting away three or four other students, this was because the way you would go study at a book at that time, you would go over to where it's chained to a row on sort of like a half kind of table.
It's like a book prison.
You would plop it open, you would move any other books out of the way, and you would sit and do your work there, because it wasn't something you could just take back to your dorm room. And because they're so tiny, that means that there's no room to the left or the right of you to work. The other problem was, these books were largely stored horizontally, as was the custom. Most books in any library of any size at the time, they were flat. They were stored flat up. And so one of the Duke of Gloucester's main, like a big innovation when helping build this library, was introducing a simple couple rows of wood planks as bookshelves. Mm-hmm. Basically, here's a space for students to put the book on top while they're using another book so someone else can use it.
Wow.
This was radical. This was like a radical new way of approaching books. And remember, like, a lot of the books at the time, you know, there's no writing on the spine necessarily. You need to look at the face of the book to see what you're dealing with. Mm. And so one of the points that Henry Petrosky makes in the book that's really interesting is that the issue of book storage only becomes a problem when you have too many books, right? You know, that like, if you're in a case where the grandest library in your region might have 12 books, they're not worried about how to store them. So it was only when you started getting someplace like Oxford, you know, or Cambridge or something like that, where they needed a way, they were getting so many books and so many people wanting to use them. Now we had to think for the first time, wait, how do we store them when they're not being used? This wasn't an issue before. They eventually came up with all sorts of elaborate ways to have like longer chains attached to the books.
They
were still stuck with chaining because you may only have one copy of something. It goes on here. He says, you know, it may never be known how and when it occurred to a librarian to arrange the books vertically on the shelf. You know, that's kind of lost to the ages. So this obviously frees up more space for books. It makes it easier to get one without disturbing another copy of the other book. But when they first started putting books on the shelves, it wasn't the way we have them now. It was spine inward.
Oh my god.
Yes. So they finally go, okay, let's get them vertical. This makes a little more sense.
Okay, baby steps.
But you just see the bare edges of the book pointing out at you. And again, this was because it wasn't necessarily a common thing to have the name on the spine. And that was where the chain was attached. They would attach the chain on the spine so the chain would go off the backside of the bookshelf.
Okay.
This is just to show you all the things that like we take for granted now. Mm-hmm. So that's just one small flavor of what this book is about. If you're a book lover or a bookshelf lover, didn't mean to turn this into a book review. But that's just sort of how he approaches telling the tale of where we got to, the things that we take for granted.
I want to go back and tell them, hey, we have an all ebook digital library. Like, what would they think? They'd burn you at the stake.
They're like, I don't know what you mean. Those words don't mean anything.
Oh, so you're a witch. Got it. We understand.
All right, and we have one last bookish goodness. Chris, you got a quiz for us?
So earlier this month, J.K. Rowling, author of several books, she tweeted something.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the tweet. This is the tweet that she tweeted. Her tweet was, "Cry, foe, run amok, faw awry, my wand won't tolerate this nonsense." This is a tweet from J.K. Rowling. Now, anything with the sentence, faw awry, that's F-A... space A-W-R-Y is probably an anagram.
Somebody working real hard to make the anagram
real hard
work.
Shove that anagram in there. Yeah, or something. Something's up.
Yeah.
And in fact, she had even said previously to this, like in a reply to someone, oh, I should post an anagram about what I'm doing.
Oh.
So yes, it was an anagram, and she was very clear that like, oh, this has some relation to something that I'm working on. So Harry Potter fans immediately set to working it out. One of the guesses that got a lot of traction was, Harry returns, won't say any details now, a week off, no comment.
That's
not bad. Yeah. Well, here's the problem. The thing with really long anagrams...
It can be so many things.
You can make them say whatever you want. For example, the sentence, I can exclusively reveal, that sentence also anagrams to... My own secret author fame news. Drink only a soy non-fat water. So obviously it's about healthy beverage selection at Starbucks.
That makes just as much sense.
Right, exactly. So the actual... Now, she had to get... I mean, she had to get clue after clue after clue, and eventually they figured out that it was... The sentence was, Newt Scamander only meant to stay in New York for a few hours. This was the first line, I believe, of her synopsis of the upcoming Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them film, or films, because they're going to, the Warner Brothers said they're going to do a trilogy.
Oh, of course.
Because everything has to be a trilogy.
They might make more money.
And if it's already a trilogy, it has to be four.
It's going
to
get a four.
They'll take the last one and they'll split it up into two unsatisfying movies. So then this, I created that anagram about drinking only soy non-fat water with help from, of course, wordsmith.org.
Yep, anagram.
Where the internet anagram server is located, helps you anagram
I am
things.
Arrangement servant.
I rearrangement servant.
Service,
yes.
Yeah.
Yep, yeah. Yep. Servant. And so they actually also have a page on wordsmith.org that has some trivia about anagrams that have been used in literature.
Oh.
In books. So here is a little mini quiz about anagrams that have been used in works of literature.
Fun!
All right. Okay.
This author created the character Vivian Darkbloom as an alter ego of himself.
Oh. Of himself?
Vivian Darkbloom. His initials were VN. Dana.
Victor Nabokov?
No. Vladimir Nabokov, yes, indeed. Yeah, Vivian Darkbloom shows up in Lolita, and that is a stand-in for the author. It's a good anagram, right?
Yeah, that is good.
In the early goings of the book The Da Vinci Code, Robert Langdon, protagonist, Tom Hanks.
Symbologist.
Symbologist. Robert Langdon.
Is that his title?
Yes.
Yes.
Harvard symbologist. Encounters the phrases, "O draconian devil, O lame saint." And these turn out to be the beginning of his journey, these anagram to something. O draconian devil, O lame saint. What was he being clued towards?
A location.
He was in the Louvre. in Paris at this point. It was cluing him towards something.
Da Vinci.
Oh, draconian devil. Oh, lame saint. It was the first.
Right, okay, so it was pointing to the first Leonardo da Vinci.
Leonardo da Vinci, the Mona Lisa. That's it. Yeah. Yep. And then, of course, he goes to the Mona Lisa and finds that someone has painted on it, "So dark, the con of man." And this leads him to Madonna on the rocks.
Okay.
They're just simple anagrams.
Well, yeah.
You think, I don't know.
That's sure, you're supposed to be able to figure them out. You got to be a Harvard
herbologist. Yeah. Exactly. I don't think so. Laptop and anagram.
Yeah, right.
Wordsmith.
In the French edition of a certain book, this character's name had to be changed to Tom Elvis Jedusor. Karen. Oh.
Tom Riddle?
Tom Riddle. Yes.
Yes. Marvolo.
Right. Yeah. So, of course, yeah. Tom Marvolo Riddle, anagrams to I am Lord Voldemort. That's how he got his name in the text. Mm-hmm. And, of course, because of this, because of the I am Lord Voldemort.
Je suis
Voldemort. Yeah, exactly. Tom Elvis Jedusor. Je suis Voldemort. Now, of course, in every different language that Harry Potter gets translated into, there's a different name.
I like that.
There's a different name.
Because they have to keep the connection.
Sometimes they're able to get really close to Tom Marvolo. It'll just change a couple of things. Or in Dutch, his name is Martin Asmadam Villigen, which is an anagram of Mijn naam is Voldemort.
So they had to call him
something totally different.
From the second book.
They had to have a new Marvolo Riddle. Yeah, oh yeah. So beginning from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, they have to start figuring out how they can do it. Yep.
Wow.
And to get to Voldemort, which they tend to keep.
Yeah.
This popular humorist sometimes goes by the pseudonym Ray Adverb.
Oh.
Dave Sedaris?
No.
Oh.
Ray
Barry.
Ray Adverb.
That's right. Ray Adverb.
Here's one that is actually a piece of trivia. This is not in the book. This is only in the movie version of Silence of the Lambs. This did not appear in the book.
That's very Chris.
At one point, I know, right? Yeah. Sure. Yep, very highly. Hannibal Lecter initially tells Clarice Starling that the killer that she is looking for, that his name is Lewis Friend. And then this is revealed. She figures out that it is an anagram for something, and she tells them that it is in reference to fool's gold, or a false solution.
Mm.
What did Lewis Friend anagram into?
Louisfriend.
It anagrams into the official name for fool's gold.
So you're looking
for what is fool's gold, actually?
Pyrite. Yeah, it's like an element, right?
It anagrams into it.
Yeah. Right. Lewis Friend. Are you looking it up on the internet?
No, I'm...
Oh, you're typing it out to look at it?
Yeah, just to look at the letters.
Pyrite is the name of the mineral itself. But the actual, like, the chemical name.
Oh, I got it, but I saw the answer.
Well, yeah, because you looked it up on the internet.
It's a chemical makeup.
Fool's gold. Karen, you want to tell us?
Iron sulfide.
Iron sulfide is fool's gold, and, yeah, Lewis Friend. And finally, having absolutely no connection to books whatsoever, maybe she reads books, the musical artist Imogen Heap released an album with anagrammed title. Colin.
That was iMegaphone.
iMegaphone. Yep, an anagram for Imogen Heap.
Of herself.
Cool.
There we go.
Cool. All right, and that is our episode about books. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about bookshelves, about anagrams, about children. Parents being sassy at children's books, and more. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And thanks to our sponsor, Squarespace. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.